Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We have an important event I want to announce right off the top. The Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War is sponsoring an event called Countering Hostility to the World Health Organization, and it is going to be on Wednesday, August 26th. From 1 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and that will be accessed by Zoom. And to register, you go to bit.ly/countering hostility with a capital C for countering and a capital H for hostility. There will be a panel of people who give attention to this issue, the very important event. And thanks to Zoom, it can be done. So again, you go to bit.ly/countering hostility, capital C, capital H. And it's going to be Wednesday, August the 26th, from 1 to 2:30 Eastern Daylight Time. And for more information, you can go to HCSW.ca, that's the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, HCSW.ca. And again, it's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we have a very special guest. I'm very pleased to speak to Stephen Gowans. Stephen Gowans has an excellent article titled Cruelty with a Point: The Continuing U.S. Immiseration of Syria. And it's published August the 19th. You can find that at gowans.blog. Stephen Gowans, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phil.
I really appreciate the title of this, because we hear this from many quarters. The U.S., the leader of the so-called free world, takes it upon itself to sort out the rest of the world, and they always do it with the intention of bringing, you know, light to the masses and prosperity down the road. And along the way, they use a lot of power, and as your article, of course, addresses the use of it in Syria, and what I guess in the old days would have been called a siege, where Syria has really serious economic problems now, added on to the bloody war, which is basically an intervention through puppets, the so-called the IS, whatever it is, terrorist organization, Turkey and others. And yet in all the commentary we read in the Western world, we seem to have the type that you are addressing, an article that appeared in Foreign Affairs magazine by Joshua Landis, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and Stephen Simon, senior director of Middle Eastern and North African Affairs. And they don't like U.S. policy, or so they say, but they attribute it to, stupidity or bad thinking. Explain to me why you say that's a mischaracterization of the way they approach it.
I mean, they're addressing what I call the foreign policy theodicy problem. So, I mean, the theodicy problem is, how can an omnipotent God be benevolent if he allows misery and cruelty to flourish? And liberals, such as Landis and Simon, ask a similar kind of question about foreign policy. So they ask, how is it that a benevolent U.S. foreign policy, because they accept without question that U.S. foreign policy is benevolent, how could it regularly produce such malignant ends? Now, there are two famous liberals who address this in connection with U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, and that was Mearsheimer and Walt, and they said, how is it that, you know, the United States can carry out such cruel policy in the Middle East, given that U.S. policy must be benevolent? And their answer was that the Israelis had hijacked U.S. foreign policy and made the United States engage in these undesirable and malignant policies.
The devil made me do it.
Yeah, so the Israeli devil made them do it. So underlying this is the idea that U.S. intentions are always good, but somehow U.S. policymakers always choose the wrong policy. So, for example, in Iraq, U.S. intentions were good, but the government was misled by faulty intelligence. I was just watching the interview with Joshua Landis that was done by Aaron Maté on his Pushback show. And Landis was talking about, he actually said this American effort, America believed, was to promote democracy in Syria. So he's of the view that that was the intention, was to promote democracy in Syria. And he also, echoing Mearsheimer and Walt, said, you know, this policy is stupid. He doesn't like U.S. policy in Syria, but he said it's a stupid policy and it's connected to the Iran policy and it's connected to Israel. It's very hard to change because it's connected to Israel and very difficult. You know, the price is high for any politician that displeases Israel. So he's just echoing the Mearsheimer-Walt view that it was the Israelis that have made the United States depart from its benevolent path in bringing democracy and prosperity to the world.
No, that's it's so important. You know, here's a question. Why didn't they ask themselves this? A British and a French colonialism go back a ways. Long ago, there was no Israel, but how did they happen to be in the Middle East?
Yes. I mean, that's a good point. And
an ignorant question, but you know.
Well, another, I mean, this whole idea of their article is that the U.S. policy is currently, it's based on cruelty and the cruelty is pointless. And it's pointless because U.S. policy isn't achieving its goals. And its goal is to essentially replace the Syrian government with one that's acceptable to the United States. So by the argument of Landis and Simon, if the United States policy has failed to achieve its goal, then it becomes pointlessly cruel. But then this suggests that you could have a cruel policy that has a point. Cruel policy would be one that achieved U.S. goals. But they argue that the U.S. policy is cruel because it's essentially starving the Syrian people. Now, to your point, I mean, the argument here is that this is a policy blunder, that the United States has no intention of starving the Syrian people, but it's just happened because they've chosen the wrong policy. But we could point to France Fanon, for example, who said when a colonial and imperialist power is forced to give independence to a people, this imperialist power says, you want independence? Then take it and die of hunger. So the use of starvation to crush independence movements or any kind of movement of local independence and national assertiveness is a longstanding one, as you point out, going back to French and British imperialism. So this isn't something that's new, some kind of policy error, unless we assume that every instance of starving an independence or people behind an independence movement is a policy error throughout history. Then, I mean, this argument is blind to the history of imperialism. Mm-hmm. And again, it's an attempt to resolve that theodicy problem. How can we explain how it is that U.S. policy is benevolent when it so apparently is not?
Yeah. It reminds me of a movie I saw. I can't say who the actor Dylan was in it, but it was the story of an abusive husband. And every time he hit his wife, suddenly he would say, "Why do you make me do this?"
Yes.
You quote Pompeo, by the way. You know, you have the that analysis that Pompeo said that to directly to the world and directly to the Islamic Republic, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes, Pompeo.
It is their fault if they starve. He's not going to let them have any food. He would, but if they're not going to be cooperative, then they have to starve.
Yeah, so he told the Iranian government that it has to make a decision that they want their people to eat. That's quoting directly from him. So unless Tehran accepts U.S. demands, and they have a long list that amounts to essentially Iran surrendering the right to make any decision of consequence independent of U.S. oversight, unless they do that, Pompeo is prepared to see, you know, this grim outcome brought to fruition. There's that. I mean, there's also the case that over 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 were killed through sanctions-related disease and malnutrition, the sanction program led by the United States. And when this figure was cited by a UN agency in 1995 and was defended as worth it by Madeleine Albright at the time, I mean, the sanctions continued for another 8 years. And, you know, the number of deaths just continued to increase. And there were no tears shed by U.S. leaders over the starvation and deaths of Iraqi children and Iraqi adults as well.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and it's the article we're speaking of, gowans.blog, and it's cruelty with a point. Given the times we live in, we're told that, of course, it's election time, and it's therefore it's either the Democrats or the apocalypse in the form of Trump. But everything you're describing actually is an inherited U.S. position shared by the Nobel Prize winner Barack Obama and George Bush, both 1 and 2, Bush 1 and 2. Don't we have a problem with this this tendency to think this has something to do with the name on the door of the president?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I think the aim of the Landis and Simon article was to take issue with what they would call Trump's foreign policy, but without acknowledging that Trump's foreign policy is largely a continuation of the Obama administration policy and the policy of administrations that preceded Obama as well. The article that they wrote about cruelty is really about a new tranche of sanctions related to the so-called CSAR Act. But what they don't acknowledge is that U.S. sanctions have been in place in Syria since 1979. And the United States didn't decide in 2011 either that the Assad government had to go. This is a longstanding U.S. policy that reaches back decades. In fact, there's the former vice chair of the U.S. intelligence estimate. He'd also been, I think, the station chief in Kabul. His name is Graham E. Fuller. He wrote an article not too long ago called "Why is the U.S. fighting or what is the U.S. fighting for in Syria?" And he pointed out that Washington, this is, I mean, to quote directly from him, Washington has sought to isolate or overthrow the Assad regime, both father and son, for over 40 years. It's perceived them as representing staunch anti-colonial Arab nationalism, resistance to U.S. goals, and a refusal to bow to Israel's ever-expanding borders and oppression of the Palestinians. And then he went on to note that the world has learned that any state that does not accept the U.S. designed order by definition becomes a rogue regime, hence losing any sovereign rights on the international scene. So, yeah, there's nothing unusual or new or novel about the Trump administration policies with respect to Syria. This is just standard Washington policy toward any kind of local or force of local independence and national assertiveness. I mean, that has been one of the fundamental goals of U.S. foreign policy from the very moment of the birth of the United States, which is to crush any kind of movement that stands in the way of U.S. economic interests.
We're speaking to Stephen Galland, and by the way, Stephen has an excellent book on Syria, and it's titled very apropos, Washington's Long War on Syria, Stephen Galland's, and it's Baraka Books, and couldn't be more timely, actually. Stephen, apropos of that discussion, you say you an interview you saw with Aaron Maté and Joshua Landis. And by the way, Joshua Landis represents in the American political firmament sort of the radical fringe. He's the go-to guy, I think. People like Democracy Now! And others turn to him. And as though he were some type of Syria sympathizer. There's an assumption they all share. And that's the other part of the equation, that this thing that Washington is out for good, so doing its best, maybe badly, sort of the ignorant new colonialist doesn't quite know how to do it. But then there's the other issue, which is the people they oppose are bad. And people who do commentary like to put in a caveat saying, well, I'm no defender of Syria. Assad is, I got a lot of problems with Assad. Why do they think they have to do that?
The historian Marilyn B. Young, who wrote an interesting book on what she called the Vietnam Wars, said that from the 1950s forward, there was an axiom upon which all US foreign policy was based. And that axiom is that the intentions of the United States are always good. It's possible that in pursuit of good ends, mistakes will be made, but the basic goodness of US intentions cannot ever be questioned. And the intentions of the enemies of the United States are bad. It's possible that in the pursuit of bad ends, good things will seem to happen, but the basic badness of enemy intentions cannot ever be questioned. And if you keep that axiom in mind, you can understand a lot of public discourse about U.S. foreign policy, because it all conforms to, or that discourse is undertaken within the context or the framework established by this axiom. Whether people know that they're using the axiom or not, they almost always are. So Landis and Simon certainly use that, because they assume that U.S. policy is always good by intention, and if it's not good, it's because something has gone wrong, because the Israelis, you know, have hijacked U.S. foreign policy.
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you do a lot of reading in, of course, history and politics. It is almost a neurotic aspect of involved with analysis and biography, etc., that to say the leader got bad advice.
Yes.
Wasn't the leader. Great guy, great woman. But it was that, what's his name? Rasputin. Must have been Rasputin. It must have been. Or they used to make it, actually, the male chauvinist used to be the woman behind the curtain, the bad wife, Lady Macbeth. It was her fault.
The scapegoats. Yeah. So there's always, I mean, the idea that the intentions of the enemy are always bad. And you can see this in the analysis that Landis and Simon do, because first of all, they have to refer to the Syrian government as a regime, using language that immediately discredits it. And secondly, they made the most extraordinary statement, an explanation for why it is that the United States must not pursue its policy of essentially immiserating the Syrian people. And essentially, their argument goes something like this. You know, we had a great intention. The United States' intention was beyond reproach. The intention was good. The intention is to pressure the Syrian government, Assad in particular, and under pressure because we assumed that he was a humane person, that he would bow to pressure in order to avoid the evisceration and starvation of his people. But we discovered that he's evil and essentially fundamentally bad, and he doesn't care about the welfare of his people. He's allowing them to starve. And therefore, we ought to cease our sanctions policy because it's not going to work with someone as brutal and base and, you know, iniquitous as Bashar al-Assad. He doesn't care if the people of Syria starve, which is quite an extraordinary statement. It's almost like, you know, the Japanese arguing that by failing to capitulate to Japanese aggression in the Second World War, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was some kind of iniquitous figure who didn't care whether, you know, U.S. conscripts died in a terrible war.
Yeah. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.blog. Well, we have to mention, of course, our values. We have a new finance minister, former foreign minister, also deputy prime minister, Chrystia Freeland, and she goes on about our values, and Assad doesn't like our values. What is it that Assad represents? It's not our values.
I think it was at the last meeting of the UN General Assembly at which the former Venezuelan, not Venezuelan, Zimbabwean president, Robert Mugabe, spoke. He said, you know, it's always assumed that the president of a republic is supposed to represent the interests of his people. But that's not what really happens. What really is expected is that the president of a republic is supposed to open its doors and its borders to some kind of free trade arrangement with the United States and the Western world to enable their people to be dominated or their economies to be dominated by Western powers, with the intention of aggrandizing, you know, corporate America or Western businesses at the expense of these often poor countries like Syria and Zimbabwe. And so the values, how are the values that Chrystia Freeland talked about and that Joshua Landis talked about are the values of free trade in an international liberal order, one that is, you know, superintended by the United States, which according to them, if one accepts, will produce prosperity and democratic governance and a thriving middle class. That's not the way it actually works out, because as many US foreign policy figures have pointed out, this international liberal order was actually developed by the United States with US interests in mind. And the intention is to facilitate the profit making of US corporations. So, I mean, I know this to be the case, that at one point, not too long ago, the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, said, you know, I represent Syria. I represent Syrian people. I represent their interests. I have no intention of allowing Syria to become a puppet state of the United States, which is exactly what the United States would like Syria to become.
Yeah. Again, it's Stephen Gowans, gowans.blog. And, you know, apropos of that, I should ask you about the current ugliness that has struck Lebanon, and it has many of the elements, the attitude of Paris and the attitude of Washington, and I assume we can in London and the Europeans, but it all takes the form of a kind of Pompeo talk. There was an explosion in Beirut, devastating explosion at a time of COVID-19 and economic crisis, and at a time when already the U.S. had decided to tighten the screws on Lebanon. Could you talk about that? And also, you've written that history on the long struggle of Syria. Lebanon and Syria are somewhat related through their struggle with being under colonialism and also being liberated. Your book is Washington's Long War on Syria. Isn't this Lebanon episode basically sort of the same game they're playing with Assad?
Yeah, and I mean, Lebanon is certainly related to Syria. I mean, greater Syria, which originally the whole idea of Syria was comprised of what is now Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan, and then was carved up and divided. And the French got what is called Lebanon and essentially created a state that was built around its clients, the Maronites. And the French deliberately built this kind of sectarian government structure to make Lebanon essentially ungovernable. And now there's a lot of complaint about what's going on in Lebanon by many Lebanese people saying that, you know, the structure of the government is completely unmanageable. And then we have people, as you mentioned, like Macron coming to France as the great, you know, colonial savior.
Yes. Can I ask you, by the way, right there, because last week we were speaking to Zafar Benghazi, who knows this area well, and I put the question, how could he, in a matter of the mechanism by which he is brought there to walk among the poor shattered population, but with a bottom line saying no blank check. Why didn't he just go ahead and slap them in the face while he was at it?
Yeah, and it's such repellent hypocrisy too. Much of the problems that Lebanon experiences can be traceable to the French and the way in which the French colonized Lebanon and exploited it and created a Lebanon that could be readily managed. And so, yes, and in terms of putting economic pressure on countries at a time of this growing COVID crisis, the United States, I think, sees the spread of the coronavirus as a great opportunity because it's essentially potentiating or enhancing the effects of their immiseration policies anyway and making them all the more effective.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Stephen Gowan. It's gowans.blog. You made an analogy that I hope our listeners, I'd like them to hear about. The way the U.S. addresses countries like Syria, Iran, Iraq, is reminiscent of the way we talk about it in our political cultures, rather the way King Leopold, who is the great demon in history now, but the way that demon is addressed is very problematic. Tell the story about King Leopold and how he was commented on.
Yeah, and to get into that, though, I mean, to lead into that, one of the points I wanted to make and one of the objections I had about the Landis and Simon article was that they're writing about Syria or U.S. intervention in Syria. And if you're going to write about U.S. intervention in Syria, I mean, the two most conspicuous aspects of that intervention are that it's flagrantly illegal, which no one really talks about, and it's manifestly imperialist. They don't mention that at all, make absolutely no reference to that, which to me is like writing a history of Hiroshima and not talking about the fact that Hiroshima was the site of the first atomic bombing. So no one talks about, you know, the U.S. military occupation of one third of Syria, simply marching into Syria and occupying the territory. They don't talk about the U.S. takeover of Syria's oil fields, which is an act of pillage, or the training and funding of insurgents to wage a war to replace the Syrian government, or U.S. missile strikes on Syria, or the imposition of sanctions, which has been going on since 1979, or the U.S. endorsement of the Israeli annexation and ethnic cleansing of part of the Syrian Golan, or this U.S. complicity in Turkey's military occupation of Syria, or the U.S. endorsement of Turkey's pillage of Syrian energy resources. So this is, I mean, as I said, flagrantly illegal and blatantly imperialist, and yet people can write articles about Syria or U.S. intervention in Syria and never mention that. So, you know, thinking about that, it reminded me of the Congo. So we had King Leopold's rape of the Congo, which had been opposed in the West. But you look at the opposition to that. Where did it come from? It didn't come from people who said, you know, this intervention is imperialist. It came from people who said, it's cruel that what the measures, the acts that Leopold is committing in the Congo are exceedingly cruel acts. So this reminded me of Landis and Simon talking about the cruelty of U.S. intervention in Syria without mentioning that U.S. intervention in Syria is flagrantly illegal and blatantly imperialist. So there were two critics of that Congo colonization by Leopold. There are those who opposed Leopold's imperialism, who are mostly ignored. And then there are those who viewed the intervention as legitimate, but just objected to the cruelty of Leopold's methods. And the people who did that were frequently lionized as great humanitarians. But what they believed was that Africans were inferior to Europeans and that they should submit to European rule, but they just felt that European rule ought to be more humane. And as someone once pointed out, their attitude paralleled that, or the attitude to Africans paralleled that of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. You know, they saw Africans akin to dogs and cats as clearly inferior creatures, which had to be kept in a servile relation to their masters, but they ought to be treated humanely. And so when you think about this, you can see this not only in the Congo issue or the Syria issue, but in wars on Iraq, for example. We had a lot of discussion about not whether the wars were imperialist and whether they violated principles of justice in war or justice to war. That is this war just? And focused instead on whether the wars were conducted in ways that corresponded or conformed to, you know, conventions about the conduct of war. So, as I said, I mean, that was one of my biggest objections to the Landis and Simon article, is that there is absolutely no mention of imperialism or illegality or whether U.S. intervention in Syria is legitimate. Landis and Simon accept implicitly that it is.
That seems to be the Gordian knot that needs to be cut. Is this the domination of liberals in the discussion? They love the word. We had these expressions, humanitarian intervention, which managed to pass at the high point of the New World Order, passing on the power of the developed states to re-enter the former colonial countries and sort everybody out. I remember we had the expression from Tony Blair's number two saying we need a imperialism with a human face. I can picture someone like Joshua Landis ending up in somebody's administration saying we're going to do this in a humane way. We're not going to be doing this in a, we're going to make sure that we don't starve people or some such thing. And then, of course, they'll be attacked as bleeding liberals. Meanwhile, the whole issue of imperialism is out the window and lived with. I guess.
Yes.
I guess. Go ahead. You go ahead.
And again, it goes back to that axiom that Marilyn B. Young pointed out. It's okay because the intentions of the United States are always good and the intentions of its enemies are always bad.
By the way, tell us about Marilyn Young. I'm very happy. By the way, people should read this article. I really urge you, go to Gowans.blog. But you cite some wonderful writers here that need to be read. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge that the ordinary person searching for information, they don't ordinarily get reference to William Appleman Williams, a wonderful American historian and therefore ignored, but also you've introduced Marilyn B. Young. Her book is The Vietnam Wars, 1945-1990, published by Harper. I'm glad you called attention. The absence of these names in discourse is part of our problem.
Yes, it is. Also, another one is Bruce Cummings, who is a U.S. historian about Korea. Interestingly, reading something that Cummings had done, or an interview he'd done recently, he pointed out that there are three significant U.S. interventions in, the Pacific, East Asia, that two of which we often, are often acknowledged, Korea and Vietnam, or Indochina. But he also pointed out another one that's often forgotten, and that is the Philippines. And he argued that the Philippines is very much, the U.S. intervention, the Philippines very much became, like the precedent for the intervention in Vietnam and the intervention in Korea.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. By the way, the Philippines is one of those teetering rocks that make up the New World Order, where we should be reminded it was the president of the Philippines who's now on the blacklist in Washington, because he said, I intend to talk to China on my own. I intend to talk to Russia on my own in the interest of the Philippines. And I don't want to be prompted by the Americans. It's a pretty fundamental statement, but they're now starting to treat him like he's a Kim Jong-un.
Yes, he's fundamentally evil for representing the interests of his own people, yes.
We're speaking to Gowans. It's Gowans.blog. Stephen, this matter of the kind of crisis we are in here with, and it is, this matter of serious, strikes me as particularly deadly because of the fact that they're doubling down. I hate the expression, but anyway, they are doubling down on trying to eliminate Assad. But isn't this a place where the New World Order that they had cranked up under Bush number one, senior former CIA chief, leader of the U.S. delegation when China was voted into the United Nations on the motion by Algeria and Albania, and George Bush Sr. was there and fighting on a technicality to prevent it. Anyhow, he has quite a history, the Bushes. He announced that there was a new world order, and it strikes me that they've been trying to operate under that banner, but they have hit a sticking point when the president of Russia, one of the evil ones, they say, Mr. Putin said, look, we're not going to vote for this stuff anymore. You might about Libya. But the flag wavers continued to try to march on despite that warning from a member of the Security Council. Now, of course, two members of the Council are becoming more vocal. But isn't this sort of a crisis of that strategy of the New World Order?
Yes, it is, because the United States has discovered that it cannot dominate the world completely and has pointed to Russia and China as its peer competitors. And certainly there's a competition with Russia going on in Syria, which is a potentially dangerous one. James Jeffrey, who is the U.S. special envoy to Syria, has been quite open about what it is that the United States is trying to do and accomplish in Syria and how it's trying to accomplish it. And he's talked about one of the things the United States is trying to do is to build a quagmire in which the Russians would become mired. So not only is the intention here to starve the Syrians and to prevent Syria from rebuilding its economy and rebuilding its infrastructure, but the intention is to keep this war going on for as long as possible to, as he said, to create a quagmire in which the Russians would become stuck. And in recent days, in recent weeks, there have been some Russians who have been killed. There have been a number of Russians killed in Syria, but recently there was a Russian general killed in Syria. Some have wondered just whether he was killed by an IED, and some wonder whether the United States has been training proxies to engage kind of covertly in actions against the Russians.
Yes, I want to interrupt you and just to say, ask you, I saw on the, I can remember about 4 years ago, a former, I think it was Bill Clinton's general, I don't know if he had a big title in administration, something to do with defense. Anyhow, he appeared on a talk show. And after the Putin statement, he said they're going to have to pay a price. And the guy, I think it was Mr. Rose, I can't think of Rose's first name, but anyhow, he said, what do you mean, kill them? Or what are you talking about? He says, they have to pay a price for getting in the way. Mm-hmm. And now you've just described, you know, some targeting, which is interesting because the U.S. is now claiming, putting out statements all over the place that the Russians are targeting them in places like Afghanistan. How long have they been in Afghanistan? 200 years? I don't know. 18. It was one of those lightning wars to put down the bad guys. And it's 18 years later, and Americans have been and are being killed. But suddenly the reason they're dying is that a Russian paid somebody to shoot them. I mean, we're entering a kind of hallucinatory period, aren't we?
Yeah, I know. Those allegations are completely absurd.
Well, this business of the new Cold War, we have to, I think I go back again to the, we're in a period where people actually anticipate that in November, they'll have a more rational leadership and everything will be fine inside the 50 states that make up the U.S. But Joe Biden, in my memory, is one of the toughest characters when it comes to asserting U.S. Special status. What is that expression? We are the
indispensable
country, and we're number one. And it was his administration that was talking about a no-fly zone for Syria. What you described, this tightening policy, it seemed to me that they would be likely to resume that language. They're already in northeast Syria. They are arming and aiding the fighters in terrorists in Idlib. Frankly, if the world is looking forward to Joe Biden, who will be their president, whether they like having an American president or not, he's their president. He is not, I have heard no signals from the Democratic Party, its congressional leaders, or the people who want to be the leader of the party, indicating anything other than a hard line on most of the world.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the nature of the foreign policy won't change for the most part. I mean, obviously there'll be, you know, cosmetic changes. But I think one of the grievances that some people or many people have within the U.S. foreign policy establishment about Trump is the way in which he presents U.S. foreign policy, which is not in a way that can make it seem acceptable to those who want to believe that U.S. foreign policy is benevolent. So, for example, in Syria, he talks about Trump, that is, I mean, says ridiculous things that are provocative, like, we're keeping the oil. I've always said that, we're keeping the oil. We want to keep the oil, $45 million a month. We keep it. Biden would never say anything like that. Biden would keep the oil, but he would present it in a different way.
He'd give it to the Red Cross or something. Pardon me.
Yes.
The Doctors Without Borders. Or actually, maybe to Hunter Biden might come in, but probably be in charge of looking after it. this is Stephen Gowans, and the title, again, it's a great title, Cruelty with a Point, the continuing U.S. immiseration of Syria. And it starts with a quote. I'm overworking Stephen today, but there's so much great information in this article. But you do start with a great quote from William Appleman Williams, and it gives us, we should also link, you point this out, with William Appleman Williams talked about U.S. foreign policy in South America. And the quote is, we take our rewards in the goodies of the imperial marketplace and in the false coin of self-righteousness. And he says, "What you know, we take from you and you will have to take the consequences." Elaborate on that.
That was his description of U.S. trade policy. So he argued that the United States, like other imperialist powers before it, had tried to impose free trade on poor countries because, and once you impose free trade on a poor country, the poor country remains poor forever. But he described U.S. trade policy as, we need, you give. So it wasn't free in any respect. But that's just a, you know, recapitulation of, say, the British policy in China, the opium wars. And but he also made a point about South Africa, which was that the United States had always talked about free trade is the key to South American prosperity. If you accept free trade with the United States, you'll prosper. He pointed out, well, that certainly hasn't worked, has it? For how many years has the United States dominated South America, and South America remains, you know, mired in poverty, stagnating in poverty, while at the same time the United States becomes more and more prosperous?
Yes, and always the American explanation is they're corrupt. No one in the U.S. is ever corrupt.
No, yes. I mean, you have to... Right. You have to blame the poverty of others that you've imposed upon them on some kind of failing that they have, rather than on the fact that you've essentially pillaged their country or forced them into a situation in which they can't develop. They're not permitted. I mean, under the Washington Consensus, a poor country is not really permitted to develop industry or advanced services. Or we can look at the United States' objection now to Chinese policy. The United States set out not to allow the Chinese to excel in robotics and AI and all of the things that the Chinese want to excel in. That's not the role the United States foresees for its the other countries of the world, all of which must take a backseat to the United States.
Yeah, it's almost the old child problem with children and parents as masters, do as I say, not as I do.
Yes, and in fact, in the early days of the United States, when the British wanted to impose free trade upon the United States, U.S. government officials said, do not do as the British say, do as the British do or did, and which is, do not accept free trade until you've developed sufficiently that you can compete on a level playing field on the international stage.
Yes. Now the new sin is pointing out their hypocrisy, which makes them pretty angry.
Yes.
Stephen Gowans, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. The articles are published at What's Left, and this one is titled Cruelty with a Point, the Continuing U.S. Immiseration of Syria, August 19, 2020, that can be found at Gowans.blog. And Stephen's book is, pull it up, but it's... What is the title, Stephen? Now that I've lost the, there it is. Washington's Long War on Syria.
Right.
I can remember anything unless I have to. Washington's Long War on Syria. Stephen Gowans, a pleasure talking to you. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Bye-bye.
Bye.